Thank you for joining us. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are some important signs pointing to new life in Michigan's economy. Brand new reports tell us Michigan's household income is up, foreclosure rates are down, and the poverty rate is down. But there is a reality of our economic recovery. Nearly a million workers in Michigan are still stuck in jobs that can't get them above that poverty line. Charles Ballard is an economist at Michigan State University. Charlie, we're seeing signs the economy is pulling out of its nosedive. But how much of a recovery is it really when nearly a million people in our state have jobs that can barely earn them a living?
There is a recovery going on. The jobless rate used to be 14% only a couple of years ago. Now it's in the low eights in Michigan, similar recovery nationally. And so things are better than they were a few years ago. But there's a long-term problem, and this has been going on not just since the Great Recession, but for the last 30 or 40 years. The people in the middle and at the bottom of the economic ladder in the United States just have not done very well at all in the last four decades, whereas those at the top have done spectacularly well. And so this is really not just a question of what's happening in the recovery from the recession. It's a very long-term issue that the U.S. for a very long time has not been producing the kind of jobs that would necessarily feed a family very well for an awful large segment of our population.
And what has caused this migration away of better jobs and the erosion?
There are a bunch of reasons, but at the top of the list is the fact that there have been changes in the technology of our economy that have rewarded those with a whole lot of skill and that have been very detrimental to those who don't have a lot of skill. 50 years ago, it really was true that there were people who would tighten the same four bolts 107 times an hour and make a middle-class wage. Nowadays, those jobs are just about all gone. That job can be done by a robot. And so the job is much more sophisticated. It involves making sure that the robots are working properly. It involves programming the computers. And the lower skill work has dried up. And so if we wanted to keep the middle of our population and the lower part of our population, keep them up, we would have to increase their skills a lot more rapidly than we have. And I think the big thing is that we haven't improved the education and training and skill of our population in a way that would keep up with the changing technology.
Let's talk about the workers right now, that 27%, nearly a million workers in Michigan stuck in these really poorly paying jobs. It strikes me these are not the kind of jobs that allow people much latitude. Let's say if you're a short order cook or you're in retail, not a lot of latitude to go seek retraining. In fact, they're probably likely to say, you don't like it, leave. There's somebody else who wants this job. So what could be the answer for these folks stuck in this situation?
It's a difficult situation. There's just no way about it, no way around it. But I think that if you're in that kind of a situation, even though that's really hard in terms of your schedule, you've got to try to take advantage of it. Here in the Lansing area, Capital Area, Michigan Works, and then the other Michigan Works around the state, there are a variety of training opportunities. It is a tough situation if you've got full-time job at low wage, especially if you have childcare issues, but it's going to be that much harder if you don't try at least to take advantage of those training opportunities.
Does this need, in your opinion, to be mainly a public sector or a private sector impetus for finding training and trying to correct this?
Oh, I think it's got to be both. Certainly, one of the big stories that Governor Snyder has emphasized many times is that there are tens of thousands of jobs in Michigan that are going begging. The employer has a job and can't find anybody with the requisite skills. And so the private sector has a deep involvement in this. But I really think that public sector has to be very much involved as well. I mean, it is the public sector through which our K through 12 education happens, and that's really crucial. And then, of course, there's higher ed, and I work for a university, and your listeners know that I have a stake in this, but I really think that the policy of systematic disinvestment in higher education that we've pursued in the last decade or so is a mistake, because what's happened is, as state support has plummeted, we've had to raise tuition and that is making it much more of a financial strain.
Let's talk about the study that we were referring to, the low-wage jobs, in terms of the presidential political race. Take away that top 1%, 5%, 10% that can make this all happen and their earnings are great. And talk about the large, large percentage of Michigan voters. What do you think their answer is to that question? Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago?
Well, I think that's a question to which some people would say I'm better off and others worse off. Also, given that 4 years ago, it's 4 years ago this week that Lehman Brothers collapsed. So that's a weird place to compare with. It was a collapse that led to devastating job losses in the last 4 months of George W. Bush's administration. And then there was no way that was not going to continue for at least several more months. And finally, the job market bottomed out nationally and in Michigan in late 2009 and early 2010. But that, I hope it was a once-in-a-lifetime financial catastrophe. But a lot of people are worse off than they were 4 years ago, but better off than they were 3 years ago, because we finally did bottom out. And so it's easy to see how the two campaigns will play that, and whether the voters react to it, how the voters react to it is, I think, yet an open question.
Professor Charlie Ballard, Michigan State University, always a pleasure, and we look forward to talking to you as the campaign continues.
Thank you for having me on the program. It's great to talk to you.
Let's go now from breathing life into Michigan's economy to breathing life into one of Michigan's most important cities. If you walked through the neighborhoods surrounding Michigan's capital 30 years ago even, you would have seen rows of boarded-up houses with some sketchy interactions on the streets. But today, Lansing residents are bringing those neighborhoods to life through art. Stateside's Emily Fox reports on the most recent project happening in Lansing's Rio Town.
I'm walking with Ryan Wirt. He's a young entrepreneur who's been living in Rio Town for the past 8 years. Rio Town is a neighborhood on Lansing's south side that used to be home to the REO Motor Company. This was a vibrant working class neighborhood, but now Main Street is pretty vacant, except for a few new office buildings.
When we first moved here, it was like, you know, there was one couple down the block that we sort of got along with, and then we just kept our heads down otherwise.
Was it dangerous?
It wasn't really dangerous, but it was sort of uncomfortable, I guess. Like, we've never, you know, we've been robbed twice, three times within the first couple of years we lived here.
But Wirt didn't give up on the neighborhood after that. He owns two houses in Rio Town. One is his own, and the other he bought for $8,000. He turned it into a recording studio where he works with local bands like the Verve Pipe. Wirt is part of a team that's been trying to revitalize the area through art. He recently put on an event in Rio Town called Art Attack. Here, you can listen to live music from local bands, scan through art vendors, and watch local artists work on a public art competition. The task for the competition is to take a pile of junk taken from a condemned house in the neighborhood and turn those materials into art within an afternoon. Some artists are welding old metal to spell out the words Rio Town. Others were using old doors or metal ceiling tiles as canvases to paint on. Wirt says this event symbolizes what's happening in the neighborhood.
The idea was we're sort of pulling things out of Rio Town that is sort of trash and then making it into something new that's art. And we sort of see that as a lot of what hopefully will happen in this area moving forward is that there's a lot of cool old buildings that are starting to get run down, but a lot of people are coming in with big ideas for them.
One artist featured in Rio Town's Art Attack is Sam DeBourbon. He's been bringing character to the neighborhood with his graffiti.
It was a couple of years ago. My friend and I got caught over in East Lansing painting just underneath a bridge that later got demolished.
And DeBourbon got in trouble. He was charged with vandalism and had to do 40 hours of community service in order to clear his record. Ironically, his community service project was to cover an old motel with graffiti. The motel was set for demolition in Rio Town, and it was an eyesore that attracted crime and prostitution.
You know, for my entire life, I never really saw it as that nice motel. It was always just kind of like, ooh, that's a crack motel.
The project got a lot of attention and helped kick off the renewal of Rio Town. Now the property where the motel once stood is used for events like Art Attack. And this idea has worked before. Less than 2 miles away from Rio Town is a neighborhood just north of the capital called Old Town. There, the streets are filled with refurbished historical buildings, cafes, and boutique shops. It's home to a handful of music festivals every year. Terry lives here. He was part of the movement to change Old Town back in the 80s.
I'm just continually amazed. You know, I've been here a long time, but it was a ghost town when I moved in. Things were quiet. Buildings were boarded up.
Terry and a group of artists open up galleries in Old Town. They use the galleries to bring people together and have conversations about how to change the community. And it's been successful. Old Town has been awarded at the national level for the changes it's made. It went from a 90% vacancy rate to a 10% vacancy rate over the past 30 years. Terry says he likes seeing what Rio Town is doing and says it might not take Rio Town the 3 decades it took Old Town to become the neighborhood it wants to be.
One thing, they've got an edge in terms of time because, you know, Old Town set an example for the rest of the city. When I moved in here, people thought we were crazy. It took a lot of effort to get the city and others to support what we were doing.
And it looks like Rio Town is already getting a lot of support. Construction is underway to make the streets more walkable and bikeable, and businesses like the Board of Water and Light and GM are bringing in around 800 employees. With a new look and more people to help renew Rio Town, there's talk that restaurants and a brewery could soon set up shop in a vacant building in the neighborhood.
So now, slowly, it's become a neighborhood where people actually want to live, and it has an identity.
That's Ryan Ward again, the guy who put on Art Attack. He's still the fearless urban pioneer he was when he moved here 8 years ago. He says once most of the construction projects wrap up in the next year, Rio Town will start becoming a dramatically different place. For Stateside, I'm Emily Fox.
Still to come, we'll take a closer look at Asian carp with Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams. How much do we really need to worry about those big slimy jumping fish we've seen on YouTube? That's coming up on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This week, West Bloomfield Township lost a police officer in the line of duty, a tragic first for the community. 39-year-old Officer Patrick O'Rourke was responding to a shots-fired call at a home, thinking he was coming to help someone in distress. Instead, a blast of bullets through a bedroom door killed Officer O'Rourke. He leaves behind his wife, Amy, and 4 small children. His funeral will be tomorrow morning. Diane Philpott knows the agony of losing a loved one in the line of duty. Her husband was Detroit Police Officer Jerry Philpott. On May 25, 1995, Officer Jerry Philpott was killed by suspected gang members, leaving Diane to raise their then-7-month-old daughter, Caitlin. Since then, as part of the group My Cops, Michigan Concerns of Police Survivors, Diane Philpott reaches out to support the families of fallen officers. Diane, you've said My Cops literally saved your life after your husband was killed. How so?
I think the biggest thing is because you're in such shock and you're just trying to breathe. All the other stuff is very superfluous. It's like slow motion. It's happening. You don't want to be there. It's almost like a dream and you're kind of waiting to wake up knowing that you're not. I think your body can only take so much. And then when you have somebody walk in and say, hi, I'm so-and-so and I lost my husband so many years ago, and I'm with this organization called the Michigan Concerns of Police Survivors, and there are many of us, and we are all here to support you. That stuck in my head as a lifeline. Even if right that second I wasn't ready to grab it, I knew there was there was somebody that made it, and they're not dead, because I really feel like I want to die. And that was my lifeline to say, okay, I got to call these people because I don't know how to do this.
From day to day.
From day to day. It was just, and without them, this, you know, whole 17 years. And I'm still very, involved with everybody and in helping the new survivors. It's just that lifeline you need, because so many weird things crop up about grief over the years that, you know, most people think you're supposed to grieve 2 weeks and you're done. Mm-hmm. And it's no such thing. It's years and years, and sometimes you never get over it. So,
and for someone who has lost a police officer husband in the line of duty, as much as the rest of the world wants to say, we're so sorry, we're thinking of you, we're praying for you,
only someone who's walked that journey really gets it.
Correct. And even then we tell people, your journey through grief is very personal. I can't say I know what you're going through. What I can say is I've been through a lot of the emotions you're going to go through, and I can tell you you're normal, which is a huge thing with a lot of the survivors, because you think about suicide. You think about stopping it. How do I stop the pain? You know, you think about all these weird things, and you think there's something wrong with you when you're – it's not. It's an absolutely normal process, and sometimes that's what really helps the survivor to get past it. It's like, oh, you thought of that too? Yes, I did, and numerous times, but I didn't act on it. All I know is I was in pain and I was trying to stop it.
You know, just as happened when your husband Jerry was killed in the line of duty in 1995, this week's death of Officer Patrick O'Rourke is such a reminder to the rest of us, the civilian world, of the risk that these men and women face every hour of every shift. And, of course, certainly after 9/11, there was such a huge sensitivity and awareness of the sacrifices our first responders and their families might be called on to make. So the question is that something that you and Jerry were aware of on a day-in, day-out basis?
You are, but, again, it's one of those things. I rely on my faith a lot. And if you love your job, which my husband loved being a police officer, if you can die doing what you love, it's so much better than being miserable, because we're all going to go. It's just, are you going to go if you're miserable? And really, a police officer is not even on the top 10 of losing your life in the line of duty. You're talking construction workers, taxi cab drivers. I mean, they're on the top of the list. So if you have to leave this earth knowing that you at least you're here doing something that you love, then to me, that's still a blessing in disguise, even if you have to lose that person.
There's been such an enormous amount of emotion and support that's come. I see it all over Facebook, for instance, from the entire area for Officer O'Rourke's wife, Amy, and their four children. Have you reached out to them?
Yes, we have. We actually got a phone call right after it happened from West Bloomfield Police Department, because we're very close with them. We've helped them do their general orders. So in case this ever happened, which thank God we had that done, then they had everything in place to help the department and the family both. So they called us immediately. So last night, I know a bunch of the survivors met with the family, and they were so very grateful that, oh my gosh, I was just waiting to meet somebody that's been through this, and we're going to need your help. And for us, that means more to us than anything. And all over the pomp and circumstances, anything to do with, you know, benefits or all that stuff that people talk about, none of that matters to the survivor. What matters is I need somebody to help me through this because I don't know how to do it.
Now, I understand you can't speak for Mrs. O'Rourke, but I'm wondering, having had to lose your husband in the line of duty, if you could help us understand what's a helpful way of showing support and caring and what's not so helpful.
Well, don't try and fix it. I always tell people, I understand when you go to meet somebody and say, I'm just so sorry. Don't add anything to that. You know, don't promise something you're not going to do. Say you're going to give prayers. That's wonderful. That's a great feeling. But don't say something to try and fix it. Like, well, God wanted him as an angel. Okay, no, sorry. Not a good thing to say to somebody. If you talk to any of the survivors, and I really would love to write a book on this, what not to say to somebody that's grieving because of the stupid things that people say that they're trying to help. But I'll just tell you, I remember everything somebody said that I thought I wanted to punch them for. And they were friends of mine. Mm-hmm. So, and later on, after I got rid of the anger towards that, I understood what they were trying to do. But I'm just telling everybody, don't say anything more than I'm just sorry and we're going to be praying for you. And then if you want to do something for the family, just do it. You know, don't tell them that you're going to not do it. Just if you want to mow the lawn, go mow the lawn. I came home one day and somebody had trimmed all my bushes, mowed my lawn. They brought me a Christmas tree the first year, bigger than my house. Just showed up at the door with it. And I'm like, okay. So if you want to do things like that, that's great for the family. But the biggest thing is just to offer your condolences and prayers and support them throughout the rest of their lives because they're just going to need it.
Your daughter, Caitlin, was an infant. She was a little 7-month-old when your husband was killed. And I know that I saw a clip of Mrs. O'Rourke expressing her worry that the little ones that she has won't remember their dad. How does Caitlin remember Jerry and think of Jerry?
Well, she actually has, even though she was 7 months old, there's at least two memories that are absolutely 100% I never told her anything about, and she had them. So for even a child that age, you'll be amazed at what they will say to you at one time. I think she was 3 or 4 and we were bowling, and it was in, you know, the lights were on and the music was playing, and I was talking with my girlfriend. She runs up and she goes, "Mom, Daddy's song's on. Mine and Daddy's song's on." I'm like, "What?" And I listened, and it's this song. It's a rap song called Tootsie Roll. And he used to hold her on his hand and dance with her all over the house, just holding her by her diaper. And I'm like, "How do you remember that? I never told you that." So it was a real memory. So they might not have a lot of real memories, but you keep that memory alive by saying your dad used to do this or your dad. People will tell them stories from now until, you know, they're grown, and they say, "You know, I remember your dad did this." So it gives them a piece back, but you'd be surprised what they will remember even at that age. They'll remember something.
I would imagine after something like this week's terrible, terrible loss, there is a public outpouring of appreciation for officers, and then it kind of gets faded to the background. And something tells me officers and firefighters would probably appreciate a little of that post 9/11 awareness of what it is they do day in and day out.
Yeah, I think they need that. And I teach a lot at the academies. I also teach at survival trainings at some of the departments. And what I try and teach the public when I talk to them, too, is, you know, police officers are human beings and firefighters are human beings. We're not robots. They come when you call for help. So the object is when you see them next time, wave. They may think you're weird because they're not used to it. But my job is to try and give them a positive outlook, is wave at a police officer and smile. Wave at a firefighter and say, "Hey, how you doing today?" That will make their day more than you could possibly imagine, because they're usually not appreciated as much after this happens.
What do you think you have learned in having to carry on these 17 years since your husband was killed in the line of duty?
I think the biggest thing is to have patience with yourself and understand that you can go one step forward and 5 steps back, and it's okay. And don't necessarily do what everybody else tells you you should do. Your spirit will tell you when it's time to do something or if it's okay to do something. People that tell you, "Well, you probably should do this, or you should do that, or you should get rid of his things, or you should pack those up." You know what? I tell them this. We tell the survivors, you do whatever you want to do, because what you want to do is correct. Not what everybody else wants to do. What you want to do is correct. So I think the biggest thing is to be kind to yourself and understand that any decision you make is okay. Not to worry about what everybody else says. It's your decision, your life, your kids. And be happy with the fact that you're going to make that decision and stick with it and not worry about everybody else.
How can the public support My Cops, the efforts of My Cops?
Well, we are a nonprofit, and we have a website, which is www.micops.org, and they can make donations on there. They can support any of our fundraisers, which we have, we'll list on there. And all the money, what we use the money for is for all the programs we have for the families. We have camp for the kids. We have Outward Bound for the teens. We have retreats for the parents, the in-laws, the spouses, the siblings, and the coworkers as well. As well as adult children, because every single category of that survivor has a different relationship with the officer. And so we find that it works so much better to have them all get together and talk about their own issues. And it really helps all of them get through that, and how to help the widow and how to help the children and how to help themselves. So you kind of try and heal everybody. And it's a great, great program. And it's like I said, we're national. So we have these programs, and My Cops actually pays for the families to go. So we have monthly support meetings. We send them to Washington, D.C. in May for the memorial. So there's a lot of really cool programs that we have for the families, and it's all over the state. So there's plenty of us around.
Thank you so much, Diane, for sharing your story with us today from My Cops. And Diane Philpott, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You can go to michiganradio.org, and you'll find links to the My Cops website, also the Officer Down memorial page. Hello, cyclists. Meet the city of Detroit. That's the goal of Tour Detroit, happening this Saturday. Thousands of cyclists taking over some 30 miles of Detroit's streets. And as Bill Lusa, director of the tour, hopes to discover the pleasures of big city biking. Bill, give us the rundown. What's on tap for this Saturday?
This year, we have the streets completely closed to automobile traffic for the entire bike route, which is a unique opportunity for a cyclist to come down and ride the streets freely. with other bicyclists. And at the end, we feed everyone and tap a bunch of kegs of beer, and all local restaurants provide food and bands play. And so it's everything from, like, for some people, it's a fitness event. For some people, it's a ride and chat and have a good time.
There are several goals you're trying to accomplish. One is just getting people on bikes and up and out. But what else do you want to try to accomplish with Tour Detroit?
Well, I used to tell people that the Tour Detroit mission was twofold. And one was to show people in the city that they could get back on their bicycles. The other was to show people that ride bicycles in the region, our city. Obviously, over the last few years, we've seen cycling become a much more popular endeavor than it has, say, in the last 20 years or so, as a daily commuting option, as a transportation option, as something people do not just for recreation, but in their day-to-day lives.
How has the Tour Detroit developed and grown? I know you've been in charge for a few years now.
The first year I rode the tour, which I think was 05, the ride was at between about 100 and 200 people. And this year, it looks like we're going to have to shut it down at 5,000.
I know the event, there's a cost to enter and to be part of this, to help fund bike lanes in the city. How much have you been able to do in terms of making greenways, and how much more do you hope to do?
Well, that's a great two-part question, because one of the big things we've been able to do over time is get sections of the non-motorized plan for the city of Detroit implemented. The original project that is near and dear to the Tour Detroit, if you will, is the Corktown-Mexican Town Green Link, which is a series of bike lanes and non-motorized paths which go throughout the southwest side. As the event's grown, we've been able to take the funds that we've raised and take this past awareness into implementation, and we can see the results of our work on the ground, which to us is important. And implementation of bike lanes in the city is actually one of the, how should I say it? From an infrastructure standpoint, a lot of times you're just looking at paint. You know what I mean? We don't have to repave a road to put a bike lane down. And in a place like Detroit, where we have really an overbuilt infrastructure for the current population as far as streets go, and a lot of people will look at that as a negative. They see empty streets. They see giant one-ways. We have the opportunity then to look at these and say, hey, you know, maybe we don't need five lanes going one way northbound on 2nd Street between downtown and midtown. Maybe we can throw two lanes of traffic, two ways, put a bike lane and a parking lane on each side, and bam, now we've got a more urban environment. To be honest, for us, it's using the most of what we got.
So why do you believe the Tour Detroit is so important for the city?
Now that we've been doing this for a number of years and it's become a bigger event, obviously people have more familiarity with Detroit now, the city itself, than they do a few years ago. When you realize that you're a person's lone experience with, you know, one, exploring the city beyond the highway and the stadium, if you will, and as soon as people have that positive experience, it kind of changes everything for them, because they have this one singular perception that they've been building their entire life, and in a day it changes.
You can't talk about bicycling in streets in a big urban area, not only Detroit, without raising the question of security and certainly perceptions that people may have who aren't familiar with this. How safe do you feel?
Most of the time I feel really safe, although I will say that, yes, you can find your way into trouble in the city. Let's not be naive about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are vast swaths of the east side that I'm just not – I mean, I'm not going to cruise around on my bike alone at night waving at people. But, I mean, and I have, you know, but – I will say that, you know, one of the things about the city is, I mean, obviously, you know, if you do choose to, like, ride in the evening or cover a lot of miles, there's always someone to go with you. And two, a lot of areas are a lot safer than they seem. Three, if you are on a bicycle, you're obviously in a lot better shape than somebody on foot.
Bill Lusso, Tour Detroit, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Cindy.
And you can find out more about the Tour Detroit. Go online to michiganradio.org. And in case biking is not your cup of tea, how about a pint of beer this weekend? You can try some local brews at Hoptoberfest in Grand Rapids with live music and great people. Just check out Hoptoberfest.com for details. If beer is not your thing, how about channeling your inner lumberjack? It's the 34th annual Festival of the Pines in Lake City, celebrating Michigan's logging and Christmas tree industries. And then there's the Michigan Irish Music Festival happening in Muskegon. Lots and lots of Irish music and dance, Irish food. And if you didn't get enough ale at Hoptoberfest, you can always grab a pint with the Irish If there's a fun festival coming up in your area, email us at michiganradio.org and we will try to spread the word. Still to come on Stateside, we'll talk Asian carp with our Rebecca Williams, see what's being done to keep these unwelcome guests out of our Great Lakes. And one of Detroit's treasures gets a helping hand from a beetle. It's Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. They've become YouTube stars, big, slimy, fat Asian carp, leaping into boats, actually resulting in broken bones as they come flailing into the boat of some poor person who just wanted to enjoy a little time on the water. The headlines about Asian carp seem to be getting more and more ominous as those carp make their way up the Mississippi, getting closer to the Great Lakes. All week long, Michigan Radio's Rebecca Williams has been taking a closer look at Asian carp. Rebecca joins us now. Rebecca, first, when we talk about Asian carp, exactly what are we talking about?
So when we say Asian carp, we're talking about four different species. The bighead carp, the silver carp, those are the YouTube sensations, the ones that jump, the black carp and the grass carp. Now, bighead and silvers are the two species that officials are the most concerned about.
You are our Asian carp czarina, and you know this is an environmental story that's really been building for quite a while, isn't it?
It has. You know, Asian carp have actually been in the States since the 1970s. They were brought in by an Arkansas fish farmer, but they were brought in actually for use in research ponds and then eventually also in fish farming. At some point, they got out.
They got out.
And they've been moving north up the Mississippi River system since.
And it seems that the drumbeats of alarm have gotten greater as they get closer to the Great Lakes. Is that a correct impression?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think, you know, we've been talking about this for several years, that Asian carp are getting close to the Great Lakes. So the question is, what will they do if they get in? What will it take for them to make a home here, get comfortable here, and then what might happen?
As you've been exploring in your reports, there does not seem to be a great amount of agreement between bureaucrats and scientists. Really, how worried should the public be about the possibility of Asian carp coming into the Great Lakes?
I mean, you're right. We're hearing a big spectrum of opinions. There are bureaucrats and some people in some environmental groups that are talking about a devastating effect on a $7 billion fishery, and then billions of dollars in tourism, and they're worried about silver carp jumping into boats when they talk about tourism. But in the scientific community, there is a more moderate view generally. There's the consensus that Lake Erie is probably the most hospitable for Asian carp. It's warm, and carp like warm water, and they need a lot of food. So they need a lot of plankton to do well. And so generally, the consensus is that they'll do well in Lake Erie. Also probably well in certain bays. So Green Bay, Saginaw Bay, places where it's warmer.
Places where people might like to go out and fish and boat.
Right, right. So there could be some conflicts potentially, especially in western Lake Erie.
Researchers are trying to track them. How do they track them?
So one of the ways that researchers have been tracking Asian carp is with something called environmental DNA. And so what they do is they can take water samples and then test for traces of Asian carp. So things like scales, mucus, poop, things that come off of the carp. And the tricky thing here is that it's not certain if they have positive DNA hits, if that's a live carp or if the DNA somehow got carried by birds and brought from one water body to another. Or if it came, maybe a silver carp jumps onto a boat, and then the water comes off the deck of that boat and gets carried into another water body.
Where have we found DNA so far?
There have been continuous positive hits in the area, in the Chicago area. Some of these have been above a system of electric barriers that are intended to keep adult Asian carp from getting to Lake Michigan. There have also been recently some positive hits in Lake Erie. About 150 water samples were taken in July. 20 of those were positive hits for silver carp.
Which was alarming or was it not?
Well, the officials I talked to with the DNR in Ohio and in Michigan were surprised to find that. Now, they still don't know. Does that mean there are live carp They're going to be doing some more testing and try to follow up there. They also did pretty extensive survey where they go out and they use something called electrofishing and they try to shock the carp out of the water and try to catch them in nets. The tricky thing is that silver carp are really hard to catch if there aren't very many of them.
All right.
And they tend to avoid nets.
And would that not also be a little hard on the fish you want to see in the waters if you're doing electroshocking?
Yeah. I mean, generally with electroshocking, you turn up a lot of fish that way.
Talk a little about this electric barrier. We've read about it. I think the general public's aware that there's this barrier trying to keep, you know, in the Chicago Canal to keep them out. It seems to be a fairly mixed view on whether that's an effective use of $20,000 a day.
It is. And so what this is, it's a system of electric barriers. There are three. And they are intended, it's electric pulses that go into the water. And if a fish, and a big fish is swimming into that electric field, it doesn't feel very good. They turn around and go back the other way is the idea. The thing is that the Army Corps of Engineers has done tests to see how effective it is. And they say it is effective. It is working. But it's effective on fish that are bigger than 2 inches long. And so there are some scientists who are concerned that juvenile fish, juvenile carp, could swim through those barriers.
People who see these stories, it seems to be someone says it's a big problem. Someone else says, I don't think so. Reports are drawn up and submitted to Congress with plans of action, not acted on. Mm-hmm. All of that leads you to wonder, are we going to wake up in 20 years and say, why didn't we stop this? Because our Great Lakes are not what they should be. They've been ruined, possibly. Is that something that could happen?
Well, so here's where the scientific community has a more measured view. There is not a single scientist I've talked to who says we should let them in. Nobody is advocating that because they say that would be irresponsible. You don't want to let an invasive species in and just see what it does. But that being said, the majority of folks I talk to, majority of scientists I've talked to, don't think the entire fishery will be affected. So they're thinking most likely possibly negative impacts in Lake Erie and some bays, and possibly on sport fish like walleye and yellow perch. It's less clear whether salmon populations would be affected, and that's, of course, one of the most popular sport fish in the lakes.
Are there other tactics besides electric barriers that only keep out adult fish that scientists can use to help keep them at bay? Other approaches?
There have been some discussion and some research on sound barriers, acoustic barriers. One of the ways that's a possible route for these fish into the lakes is bait shops. And there are, when Asian carp are little, they look a lot like gizzard shad, which is a bait fish, a popular bait fish. So there's some concern that they could be accidentally introduced. The other major concern for introduction is intentional introduction. Somebody just taking Asian carp and putting them in the lake. There's also a market for Asian carp. Some Asian markets sell Asian carp, especially in places like Toronto. And so although it's illegal to move carp in the Great Lakes region, but for a lot of years it was legal.
In fact, you raise a question. I wondered, is there a market if they do come? Would it conceivably someone be able to make money catching and selling Asian carp? Are they edible?
They are edible. They are, in fact. And there are some businesses in Illinois that are catching them and harvesting them and shipping them to China and Europe and even some Los Angeles markets.
And have you ever tried it?
I have.
And don't tell me it tastes like chicken.
It does not taste like chicken.
What is it like?
You know, it was pretty mild. It was not fishy. The way I had it prepared was sort of like a crab cake. So there was some butter and some cream.
Okay.
You know, you mix those things in, it's kind of hard to tell. But it was pretty good.
Rebecca Williams brings us the Environment Report right here on Michigan Radio. And you can hear the next installment of her special report on Asian carp. It'll be coming up today at 5:45. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's called Hitsville, USA. the little house on West Grand Boulevard in Detroit that Berry Gordy Jr. bought as a home for his new record company, the one that grew up to become the legendary Motown. These days, Hitsville is a museum dedicated to sharing the Motown magic with fans who come from all around the world. One such fan was in Detroit one Sunday in July 2011. And before he performed for 37,854 fans at Comerica Park, Sir Paul McCartney had a request to visit Hitsville. That visit led to McCartney's adopting the battered old piano he saw in Studio A and paying to have it meticulously restored by Steinway. More than a year later, the piano is restored, it's ready to play those Motown sounds again, and it will do exactly that at a charity concert Sir Paul is putting on next week in New York before shipping the piano back to Detroit. Robin Terry of the Motown Museum joins us now. Robin, I want you to start by taking us back to July 2011. Sir Paul McCartney is going to play this huge gig at Comerica Park, but first, he wants to take a field trip. Why did he want to visit Hitsville?
Well, I think that's a question that you have to ask him. But based on some of the quotes, obviously, the Motown music has played an important part not only in the music that was created by the Beatles, but just, you know, both of these musical legacies had tremendous impact on one another and on American culture. And so to be this close to it, he had to come and see it. And, you know, the experience for him, I think, was one of nostalgia. It was something that took him back to even his own childhood. There was a point in his tour where he stumbled on a photo of a very young Paul McCartney with Berry Gordy Sr. and several of Motown founder Berry Gordy, three of his children. And he paused at that photo because it had to be like early, or probably around the late 60s. And he paused at that photo and really just became teary-eyed over it. I think it was just sort of, you know, that going back to how life was at that time and how simple it was and how moved he was that at that time there he was with Motown founder Berry Gordy's father and children. And then beyond that, I think just the whole experience, you know, he referred to Hitsville as the Holy Grail when he left. And I think there's something about being in that space that's just magical because you're literally standing in the footsteps of these tremendous artists and this incredible talent that all came out of this one little stable, this one house called Hitsville, USA.
So when did the Motown Museum hear that he had taken an interest in the piano, in that old piano
that
he saw?
It was almost immediately. I mean, Mr. McCartney had his performance that evening and then called back within a day himself to say that he wanted to do something for the museum. And while taking his tour, he wanted to play that particular piano. And it was out of tune. It was not in any condition to be played. And so that was the contribution he wanted to make. He said it would be great if that piano could be restored to recording quality. And, you know, sure, he said, would you accept this gift? And we said, absolutely. And that began this wonderful journey and this wonderful partnership with Steinway and Sons out of New York. The piano was moved. They put in a temporary piano. And the piano has been there for now a little over a year being fully restored.
Wow. Tell us a little about this piano, Robin. What kind of piano, and where was it used? What's its history?
It's a wonderful piano, and I have to tell you, you know, maybe the best part of this whole process has really been getting to know this piano better. I mean, really, it's this piano was built in 1877, and we've traveled to Steinway, and we've seen the books that they have there at Steinway, and it's, you know, handwritten when this piano was purchased in 1877, and you see that it's you know, signed off on, it leaves the Steinway facility, and then it makes its journey wherever, it makes its journey for some time. And then it starts making its way back in this direction and is acquired by the company Golden World Records. And their studios became known as Motown Studio B. And so that's kind of how it became part of the Motown family of instruments. And so you had music being made, Studio A, Studio B, and this piano just became part of that process. There's actually some wonderful stories as we've researched this piano and its journey with Motown. There's just some wonderful stories about musicians like Earl Van Dyke playing this piano. And this particular piano had a reputation for not staying tuned.
So and it had a personality.
Yeah, it did. And there's a great story that one of our engineers was telling me about, you know, how Earl Van Dyke at one point got really frustrated with this piano. And he said, you know, this piano is going to take a major restoration to ever be in good, solid recording condition. And here we are all these years later, and it's finally getting that restoration.
And the big celebration, the piano's coming out party, is September 18th, next week. What's going to happen and who's going to be there? Obviously, Sir Paul McCartney.
Well, we are thrilled that Sir Paul McCartney not only took an interest and shares all of our love for Motown and Motown legacy, and then partnered with Steinway, and together they have restored this piano. And so he agreed, along with Motown founder Berry Gordy, to host a small, you know, group of friends and patrons at Steinway Hall in New York on the 18th, and that's what they're going to do.
Robin, you're the grandniece of Berry Gordy. You're the granddaughter of Esther Gordy Edwards, who founded the Motown Museum. I want to talk about your sense of perhaps family pride in your ties to the museum. When you walk around that museum, where does your mind go?
Oh, wow. When I walk around the museum, it's one of those things. Today I feel an enormous amount of pride in what my grandmother did, Esther Gordy Edwards, to preserve this history. You know, you talk to people like Smokey Robinson and Stevie Wonder, and they talk about how, as young artists, you know, coming up in the industry, they had no idea that they were creating history. You can talk to any of the artists or musicians. They had no idea they were creating history. They were doing what they loved to do, and that was make music. And to think that my grandmother somehow understood that what they were doing in 1959, 60s, early 70s, and then even on, you know, to California, but what they did here in Detroit, that somehow that would someday be important for someone else to know, or that someday that might inspire somebody else, that gives me great pride. Just the fact that I am the person who's able to sort of keep that flame going, keep that torch lit, it's an enormous sense of pride.
Robin Terry, have a fun time in New York with Sir Paul McCartney on the 18th, and thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside today.
Oh, I thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark, dancing with me around the studio to the sounds of Motown. We had production assistants from Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside's engineered by Bob Scon. Tamar Charney is the station's program director. The director of broadcasting for Michigan Radio is Steve Schramm. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening. Jen White and All Things Considered is up next.